Do you know someone from Wisconsin who fought in World War II? For me, it was my great-uncle Alvin Sheblock from Oconomowoc. Al served with an Army unit in the South Pacific, including campaigns in New Guinea and the Philippines. It feels like everyone in Wisconsin has ties to World War II. And coming up in today's show, reporter Meg Jones talks to Brianne Chasseau about her new book on World War II and Milwaukee. Thanks for tuning in to today's Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. In news this week, reporters Patrick Marley and Jason Stein broke the story of safety issues at the Lincoln Hills School for Boys. That school's just north of Wausau, and the school has been criticized for attacks on juveniles and staff members. Reporter Chelsea Lewis talked to Jason Stein about breaking this story and its fallout.
So, Jason, for the past week, you and reporter Patrick Marley have kind of been tracking this story about an investigation into a juvenile prison in northern Wisconsin. Can you kind of provide a little information, a little background on how that story broke?
Yes. Patrick Marley got a call from sources up north of Wausau. It's called Lincoln Hills School for Boys. And over the weekend, roughly 50 state investigators and attorneys descended on that facility and began interviewing, you know, all the staff and inmates in sight. And the interviews there have been going on for days.
Wow. So what prompted this kind of raid on the prison?
It's not totally clear. It is clear that multiple complaints were raised from inside and outside this juvenile prison, and that the State Department of Justice started an investigation in January, and then this fall they opened what's called a John Doe investigation. And we reported yesterday that there is a very broad series of crimes, from second-degree sexual assault to witness intimidation and misconduct in office, that are being investigated as part of that John Doe probe.
So what prompted a judge to kind of open up some of the records on this probe?
It's unclear because, you know, the authorities, the investigators and judge are not talking directly. But, you know, I mean, this is a situation where you have, up until a few weeks ago, we have it confirmed that juveniles have been harmed at the facility. We have allegations that staff have been harmed at the facility. So an obvious concern that any, I think, good faith investigation would have would be taking steps on the one hand to shield the identities of witnesses so they aren't hurt, but at the same time, if the public becomes aware of the investigation, that may in some ways also help put pressure, appropriate pressure in place to ensure the safety of people involved. So, I mean, but it's impossible to speculate on why they did what they did because, you know, investigators are typically not going to talk at this stage of an investigation.
Sure, sure. There have also been a couple of administrators who have stepped down, or I guess they said they've retired. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, they've left their jobs. They've been scheduled to retire in January, and then on Thursday of last week, this investigation really ramped up, and that day they left their jobs. And that's really all we know. And, you know, as of last month, the state correction secretary was praising those two men, and now he's called their actions into question. So, you know, it's been an evolving situation, and we are obviously asking the question about whether or not higher-ups at the Department of Corrections were taking appropriate actions to protect their own workers and protect juvenile inmates.
You mentioned that you have some evidence of children that have been harmed. One of those potential cases was a potential suicide. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, we know that in the fall, a girl or youth attempted suicide came close enough to succeeding that the coroner was called in Lincoln County, but ultimately survived. We don't know her health status. We know that on the weekend of November 28th and 29th, a juvenile at the facility was seriously harmed by, physically harmed by actions from a staffer. We do not have, we have some rumors about what that action was. We do not have that confirmed. We're not in a position to report on that. But we know that that also served to ramp up the investigation. So we know that within recent days, juveniles at the facility have been harmed.
Is the DOJ still interrogating or questioning employees at the facility, or where does this investigation go now?
They were questioning them as of yesterday. It's unclear. I mean, the investigation is very broad, and the net that these investigators are sweeping is very broad. So on the one hand, they will have a lot of things to go through. On the other hand, they may well be feeling pressure to act quickly because of the recent, you know, at least one recent case in which a juvenile sustained injury.
Stay tuned for more coverage from Jason and Patrick as the story continues. To find last week's stories on this, visit jsonline.com/news. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones covers military and veterans issues. She's also the author of a newly released book, World War II Milwaukee. In this book, Meg used past interviews and archival materials to tell the story about Milwaukee and the role its citizens played in the war. Here's reporter Brianne Shawso talking to Meg about what readers can look forward to and about a section of the book in which Meg shares the story of reporters with Milwaukee connections who interviewed Adolf Hitler.
First things first, Meg, tell me overall about your new book that's coming out.
Well, it's a book about Milwaukee during World War II. It's not a comprehensive history of World War II here in Milwaukee, but it just highlights some of the fascinating people, mostly warriors, witnesses, and workers that kind of were instrumental in the war. So I start off with when I was first approached by the History Press last year, late July. And I ignored the email for a couple of days because I thought it was spam. And then I realized what it was. I'm like, oh, that sounded a little interesting. But I was literally leaving for Afghanistan in like 3 days. So I wrote the editor back and I said, I'm going to cover another war right now. This is kind of, I did note the irony of that it was that they were asking me to write about one war when I was going to off to write about another one. But I said, I should be back in a month. If you're still interested, you know, get back in touch with me. And to their credit, they did. And they said, you know, it can be about whatever you want to write about for World War II. They didn't really say it's got to be this or that. And at first, I didn't know what to write about. But then I remembered that the captain of the USS Arizona was from Milwaukee, grown up in Milwaukee, and lived here up until the time that he left for the Naval Academy. And then pretty much, his name was Franklin Van Valkenburg. And then he pretty much made the Navy his entire career. So he never really came back home to Milwaukee. So I knew that the captain of the USS Arizona, which that's kind of the iconic image from the start of the war for America, World War II, was the Arizona blowing up and burning in Pearl Harbor. And then I thought, you know, there was another person with strong Milwaukee ties that strut across a deck of an entirely different ship under incredibly different circumstances 4.5 years later, and that was the USS Missouri, where Douglas MacArthur signed the armistice using Wisconsin-made pens, by the way, Parker pens, that ended World War II. So I thought, here are these two iconic images that you had from World War II, and Milwaukee had a central part for both of those. And I thought, well, I could use that as a framing device and then have chapters on Milwaukee's mayor that went off to war and never came back. And I could write chapters about Wisconsin manufacturers, some companies that you pretty much knew that they, you know, it's pretty much accepted wisdom that they were integral to the World War II. And then some you'd be like, oh, really? I didn't know about that.
When you were contacted about this book, you were going off to cover another war. And while you were doing research and whatnot on material for this book, did you ever find that your work in covering, you know, war and veterans and issues surrounding that helped as you were preparing a book about a a past war?
Yeah, I would say it did in that I never served in the military myself. So it wasn't until I became an embedded reporter in Iraq and Afghanistan that I really had to learn the lingo, had to learn what ranks were, the difference between a regiment and a battalion and a company. And that helped me out a lot. I've just read a lot of World War II history anyways because I just have an interest in it. But when I was, I do have three chapters on Milwaukeeans who were journalists that served over on the front lines. So Dickie Chappelle, who was in the news recently because it was the 50th anniversary of her death in Vietnam just last month. And then I've got a guy by the name of H.V. Kaltenborn. He was a CBS newsman. He was, his title was kind of Dean of Broadcast News, and he had kind of this baritone. He was fluent in German, and I think that's why he was able to spend a lot of time over in Europe. He interviewed Hitler a number of times, even before Hitler became chancellor. And then H.V. Kaltenborn's papers are at the University of Wisconsin, or at the Historical Society at Madison. And I was over there researching his papers, and one of the librarians said, oh, you know, we've got all of Lewis Lochner's papers too. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. So then I looked a little bit on Lewis Lochner, and he actually turned out to be, of all the three journalists that I wrote stories about, he actually turned out to be the most fascinating character. He grew up here in Milwaukee, fluent in German, and he moves to Germany in the early 1920s, goes to work for the Associated Press in Berlin. In 1924. 1928, he becomes the Associated Press Berlin bureau chief from 1928 until 1941. So a few days after the Pearl Harbor attack, Germany declared war on the United States, and German journalists that were in America were interned. And so he knew it was just a matter of time that he was going to be interned. But from 1928 until 1941, he had a front row seat to what was going on in Germany. He could see, and so that was actually one of the most interesting chapters for me to write because, A, I'd never heard of Lewis Lochner, but that's not unheard of because, you know, a lot of in AP people don't have bylines. So probably the way that people find out about Kristallnacht, about all the various invasions by Germany, they were probably reading it from Lewis Lochner, although they wouldn't have known it, would have just said AP on it. So Lewis Lochner, it's interesting because Lewis Lochner and H.V. Kaltenborn met with Hitler in 1933 at his retreat in Bavaria. And I've got a vignette in one of the chapters about it, but it was just hilarious because they both talked together and they said, okay, you know, Hitler is just going to dominate the conversation. We've got to, like, be able to, like, jump in and ask our questions because we've got a bunch of stuff that we want him to answer. And H.P. Kaltenborn explains, you know, sets the scene. So they're in this beautiful Bavarian retreat. They're outdoors. And granted, this is before Hitler is chancellor, but so this is, like, maybe 6 months before Hitler becomes chancellor. But they already know that the guy is not a very good he's not a good guy, even at that early apart. They're interviewing Hitler, and he's being very dictatorial and railing about this, that, and the other thing. And at one point, Hitler's dog comes over to him, this kind of a wolfhound. And so the dog comes over, and Hitler, like, yells at him, like, "Platz!" You know, and he tells him, you know, and he points, and the dog skulks away. And then he's still, you know, foaming about the mouth about something or other. And at some point, H.V. Kaltenborn notices that the dog is kind of like, sort of looking at him. And then when he sees, like, he's not being paid attention to, then he kind of slinks away. So H.G. Kaltenborn is like, you know, if the man's not even nice to his dog, you know, if this is the way he treats his dog, what's, and this is early on. I mean, this is years before they even see what's, you know, what's going to be happening. But it's interesting because here are these Milwaukee guys kind of front and center at, you know, as history is unfolding. And so those chapters are kind of interesting for me to write. And as I'm writing them, especially the Dickie Chappelle chapter, I was thinking she had to really, it was rough for her, especially during World War II, because she's a female. And the military commanders are like, no, we don't want you to be out there. We don't want you to get hurt. There's no bathroom facilities. And Dickie Chappelle is, listen, you know, I can take care of myself. I can, you know, don't worry about me. And I wrote in the foreword to my book, I said, you know, I kind of like to think that because of people like Dickie Chappelle, it's because of what she went through, that's how I was able to cover the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And nobody really paid me any mind or, you know, gave me any, you know, difficulty because I was female. And I also like to think that, you know, had all three of these, H.V. Kaltenborn and Lewis Lochner and Dickie Chappelle, been working now, I'm sure they would have embraced social media. I'm sure they would have been on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. I just kind of like to think of what that would have been like for them and what it would have been like to cover something like World War II in today's age.
Several excerpts from Meg's book are available at jsonline.com. And if you're interested in picking up a copy of the book, World War II Milwaukee is available online and at some local bookstores. Aluminum Christmas trees had their heyday back in the 60s. But if you're nostalgic for them, then you should head to Manitowoc. Here's Mary Louise Schumacher and Chelsea Lewis with more.
Chelsea, you have this great story this Sunday about a place where people can make a pilgrimage to see aluminum Christmas trees. So, first of all, tell me how this story came to you.
A woman in Manitowoc contacted me and said, "Hey, we've got this really great display going on downtown this year. I just thought you'd like to know about it and let other people know about it." So she was with the Downtown Association in Manitowoc, and they have put up more than 60 aluminum trees throughout downtown in some storefront windows, and some of them are actually inside businesses. They're calling it Evergleams on 8th, and that's after the name for the trees, Evergleams, which actually were made in Manitowoc in the 1950s and 60s. So it's this really cool bit of history about Manitowoc that not a lot of people know about, but also a nice holiday display.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about why Manitowoc is an appropriate place for this. These trees kind of come from there.
Yeah. So in 1958, I think it was a salesperson with Aluminum Specialty Company, which was this big manufacturer of primarily aluminum children's toys in Manitowoc. Mm-hmm. He was down in Chicago and he saw this aluminum tree in a Ben Franklin store. And he was like, "Wow, that's cool." So he found the company that made it. Turns out it was really expensive. Mm-hmm. So he said, "I think we can make this cheaper and I think people will really like it." So they kind of licensed the patent. Mm-hmm. And then in 1959, so within like 3 months of seeing that tree, they had a prototype on display at this toy show in New York. And then that first holiday season, I think they made like 250,000 trees.
Wow.
So yeah, over the next 12 years, they produced over 1 million trees. They started with silver. Silver was always their bestseller, but then they added, you know, gold, green, blue. Pink is kind of the rare one these days that people really want. And, of course, from a Charlie Brown Christmas special, everyone knows that Lucy wanted that pink aluminum tree.
Right.
So, yeah.
And you give a great description of the different kinds of trees in your story, too. Can you tell us a little bit about the different models? And do you have a favorite?
The pink one is really cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's all different sizes. They had everything from little 2-foot tabletop ones to 7-foot trees. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that they didn't make any bigger than that because at that time, you know, ranch houses were the thing and no one had room for anything bigger than a 7-foot tree. Mm-hmm. And all different styles. You know, some were skinny, some were fat and full. There's this style called the peacock where they just had branches on one side. So it was kind of flat like a peacock. It looks like a peacock. But I think I really love just like the classic silver with the color wheel. So this color wheel was an accessory that most people got or some people got with their trees. And you weren't supposed to hang lights on your tree. You were supposed to use this color wheel to project light onto the tree and it changed colors. And sometimes the tree spun. So it was just kind of this spinning, colorful, fantastical display.
Yeah. And so is this display in all of these storefronts a way to kind of drum up some interest in downtown Manitowoc too? And if so, I mean, are there other cool things to do in Manitowoc for people who go to see the trees?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was one reason. These trees were donated for this display by a private collector. So they're still his, but he's from Manitowoc. He wanted to kind of draw people to downtown Manitowoc, let them know a little bit about this cool history that Manitowoc has. So, yeah, they're in display in like more than 30 businesses, I think. And the idea is to hopefully get people to come, look at the trees, shop in the stores. Manitowoc has a great little chocolate shop, Bernstein's. There's a great bike trail there. You know, I'm an outdoors person. The Mariner's Trail goes from Manitowoc to Two Rivers. Really nice paved trail along the lake. So there's tons to do downtown there, and they're hoping that this draws more people.
If you're interested in more details on this story, pick up today's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can also find Chelsea's story online at wisconsintrails.com. Attacks like the ones in Paris and California have prompted national security to become a top issue in the elections, including the Ron Johnson versus Russ Feingold campaign in Wisconsin. Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert joined our JS on Politics show on Thursday with his insight into this divisive campaign issue.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, to talk about national security and how it's become an increasingly important topic in the U.S. Senate race. Now, Craig, you've written a bit about this and you have more to come. Let's start with Senator Ron Johnson. I'd like you to just try to summarize a little bit. What's his take, his worldview on things like terrorism and ISIS, and how does he come at that issue?
Well, he's chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. He's also a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He's been pretty outspoken on a lot of issues, from Benghazi to Iran. He's a really outspoken opponent of the Iran nuclear deal, which Russ Feingold supports. And he's also been one of the more outspoken Republican senators about the idea of putting boots on the ground and sending a significant number of American troops into Iraq and Syria to displace ISIS, to take their territory away. He argues that that is an essential component of any strategy to defeat ISIS. And not surprisingly, he's a consistent and vociferous critic of President Obama's foreign policy.
All right, now let's talk about Russ Feingold, who he'll be facing again in next November. And where does Russ Feingold come at issues like that?
Well, unlike a lot of Senate races, you know, we have a senator and a former senator. So he's got a rich history. He's known as the only Democrat who voted against the Patriot Act after the 9/11 attacks. He was one of only 23 senators to vote against the Iraq War under President Bush. He's been much more skeptical about military intervention than Senator Johnson. He's against the idea of trying to invade and then occupy Iraq and Syria again. He argues that it would be counterproductive and that we have no way to hold that territory if we were to take it. And he is supportive of the Iran nuclear deal. So you have a lot of fairly dramatic differences between two people that have records and that have platforms and have spent a lot of time on these issues.
All right. So we're still a ways off from the election, of course. But where, I mean, in terms of where the American public is today, do you think they align more closely with Ron Johnson or Russ Feingold's take on how to approach
Well, it's kind of a moving target, and it depends to some degree on what the issue is. Some of these issues cross party lines, like the Patriot Act and civil liberties and national security. There are differences within the Republican Party. I mean, Ron Johnson, you know, supports restoring the NSA mass surveillance program that fellow Wisconsin Republican Jim Sensenbrenner took out. And there's divisions within the Republican Party on that issue. There's divisions within the Republican Party on the use of troops. So there's a lot of interesting things to watch here. I think there's a sense that national security is becoming a bigger deal. The conventional wisdom is that usually when national security emerges as a bigger issue, that's a bigger challenge for Democrats because voters tend to see the Republican Party as, quote, tougher on national security. But it's never that simple, and there's a lot of interesting cross currents in this race. I mean, national security is typically not the decisive issue and hasn't been in most recent elections, and it'll be interesting to see whether that changes at all in 2016.
As always, the full replay of that show is available at jsonline.com/politics. You can also find a full podcast version of that show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Now, I hope this doesn't turn any of you off of this podcast, but I did go to the University of Illinois. I was there in 2008 when the University of Southern California, or USC, whooped my alma mater during the Rose Bowl. So I feel for Badgers fans after it was announced that their team would take on USC during the Holiday Bowl. What issues will the Badgers need to address before the game? Here's Jeff Patricus's take.
Well, probably the number one issue all season, I think most Wisconsin fans were aware of this before the season, was that the offensive line was going to be inexperienced and a significant question mark, and it became even a greater issue when they had just a horrific string of injuries in camp. And early in the season, they had five different starting combinations through the first seven games. And in their last regular season game against Minnesota, they started another different combination and probably might have had one of their better performances overall. They moved their right tackle inside the guard, popped in a different kid at right tackle and got a pretty solid performance. So my guess would be that that unit we saw against Minnesota will be the same unit we'll see against USC. And I think that probably gives them the best chance to beat USC because USC's got some problems on defense. And their new head coach, Clay Helton, who went from interim to full-time coach during the season, fired three defensive assistants. So they're going to be down four assistants, three on defense, as they prepare for the bowl game.
Okay, now, anytime that you make a bowl game, and it is an important thing, so what would you say that this game means for Paul Christ and then also for the team?
It's probably twofold. You've got some seniors who are going to be playing their last game who have been through a tremendous amount of upheaval. They had Brett Bielema as the head coach in 2012. He left. Gary Anderson comes in, coaches for 2 years. He leaves after two seasons. Both times, Barry Alvarez took over as head coach. One time they lost in the Rose Bowl. Last year they were able to beat Auburn in overtime in the Outback Bowl. This year you've got a new guy in Paul Christ who's come in, brought in some stability. He's not going anywhere. I think the fact that this team has had a good year, 9-3 right now, but the three big teams they played, Alabama, Iowa, and Northwestern, were all ranked. They lost all three of those games. So I think they would like to cap and turn a good season into a very good season by beating USC. And for the younger players, the bowl practices are very valuable because they've got a lot of young guys, not only who are starting, but who are key reserves and some developmental guys that the coaches can take a look at during bowl practice.
Okay, and then for the coach, Paul Christ, what does making this bowl game mean for him?
You know, he's so laid back. It would be fun if you'd ask him that question. He'd kind of look at you like you're from a different planet, like you just parachuted in, because it's no way about Paul. It's never about him, never will be. He really likes this team, and he's mentioned it several times this year that he's still getting to know these guys, because it's only some of the older guys that some of the maybe fifth-year seniors who were part of the program when he was here last in 2011. So everybody else he didn't really have anybody in contact with until this year. So he's mentioned it several times that it's been fun for him to get to know these guys, what they're like as people, what they're like as athletes, how they respond to certain situations, how you can push them, what you need to do to push the right buttons to get them to excel. And I think he's really looking forward. I think he's very hopeful that for them, that especially for the seniors, their final game is a victory as it was for last year's crew.
And then this question for you. Now, you cover the Badgers, you get to see them live in action. What would you say is the most interesting part of your job, and then maybe the most frustrating or difficult part of your job?
Interesting part of the job is easy. One of the things I like about covering college athletics is you see, if a kid stays 4 years or 5 years, you see for the most part, a tremendous amount of change, growth, maturation. Some kids don't change. They just maybe they don't last 4 years. They drop out. But if a kid stays 4 or 5 years, and if he's a good kid and he works hard both in the classroom and you know on the practice field and in the weight room, whatever, you see him grow and mature. And it's really fun to see it cycle through every 4 or 5 years. Where you see the new kids come in, see sometimes they're just wide-eyed as freshmen or not very open, don't like talking, very unsure of themselves, and how they grow a little bit into adulthood. I enjoy that more than anything else. Frustrating is just probably not as much access as we've had in past years to where you can sit down and get to know coaches and players a little bit more on a personal level. You're so crammed for time that it's like, ask your questions, do your job, move on to the next, and it sometimes feels a little bit impersonal. Not always, but sometimes.
To follow along with Jeff's coverage of both Badgers football and basketball, visit jsonline.com/sports. And with that, I'll wrap up today's show. Thanks so much for listening. If you're a fan of the show, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And don't miss next week's show. We've got a bit of a holiday surprise in store there. So stay tuned and take care until next time.